Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Frank Buckley with us. Frank is probably well known to many of the listeners out here. He is Foundation Professor at George Mason University's Scalia School of Law. He's the author of many books. Had an article in First Things last year. The last book was The Republic of Virtue. And the main topic today is a book that just came out with Encounter Books. And it's got an interesting title, and that's going to be my first question, Frank. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
All right. So here's the full title and subtitle. The Republican Workers' Party. Wait, I thought it was the Republican Country Club Party. Okay. The Republican Workers' Party. Subtitle, How the Trump Victory Drove Everyone Crazy and Why It Was Just What We Needed. So, Frank, let me just go to the title. This is obviously... an extraordinary shift, right, in the identity of the party. So, I mean, this is a question that could go on for 10 hours. But quick, what is the Republican Workers' Party? Why are you calling it that?
Well, first of all, I ripped off the title from Trump himself. He referred to his movement as the Republican Workers' Party, and he also said he was going to be the jobs president. Right? He said. I'll be the greatest jobs president America's ever seen. And you know what? It seems like he's right in terms of how the economy is bouncing back. The jobs are coming back. What's special about jobs? What's special about work? What's special about it is that the left and the right, too, had forgotten about the importance of work for all of us and jobs. Jobs provide us with a sense of belonging to the community, a sense of self-respect, a sense that we're contributing, and also a sense of independence. And so there is that passage in Proverbs, which the author of the painting on the cover of my book, Ford Madox Brown, painted onto his painting, "Seest thou a man swift in his labor, he shall stand before kings." Right? So the idea is, if I have a job and I'm producing and I know I'm delivering the goods, then I'm independent. I'm not beholden to anyone. Contrast that with the Julia ads for the
Democrats. The Life of Julia, of course.
Right, which is all about what the government does for you. And the message behind the Republican Workers' Party is, I'm doing it for myself. It was also a moral message, in the sense that, a thin moral message, in the sense that all the government should be doing, the only mandate for the government is create the economic conditions where we have work for people. And after work follows marriage and families and mortgages and houses and all the things which make us moral. And by contrast, Hillary Clinton wanted to lead a moral reformation crusade, deeply flawed though she was. She now, it appears, wants to be a minister of some kind. I recall Baudelaire in similar circumstances saying, I wonder how it is that she would ever be admitted into a church. What conversation could she have with God?
You mentioned, very good, you mentioned the new class, capital N, capital C. And one thing that occurs to me right off the bat when you talk about the importance of work is the way in which the new class, maybe other names for them, the liberal elite, really divide up work. There is some work that is dignifying and productive and forward-looking, and other work isn't. No sense among the elite that honest work is honest work.
Well, there was for the left certain kinds of work which was respectable and certain kinds of work which wasn't. Hillary Clinton campaigned in coal country, Kentucky, in 2016 and said, you know, sorry to tell you guys, but, you know, the coal industry is going to shut down, but that's okay. We're going to train you for high-tech jobs. So those kinds of intellectual pursuits, those are the sorts of things that the new class thinks is the ticket to the future. Absolute nonsense. The jobs aren't there for ordinary people, and the ordinary people are not suited for those kinds of jobs. What they are good at is laying track in the hole. And I was vastly amused to find that one such county, Harlan County, Kentucky, which was the site of the Harlan County Wars, big Union battle in the 1930s, and the subject of a song by Pete Seeger, "Which Side Are You On?" Harlan County went 90% for Trump.
I remember some of my liberal acquaintances, you know, 8 months before the election, scoffing, laughing at the idea that Trump was going to bring back any manufacturing. It's over. It's the information age. It's the new economy. And how have you heard any recognition, any acknowledgement that at least right now it looks like Trump was right?
Yeah, Trump was right, and the left is gone barking mad. And, you know, there's a simple explanation for politics today, at least for what you read of politics in the media. And the explanation is Trump stole their lunch. The campaign, I worked on the campaign, I helped write speeches for the candidate. The thinking all along was we're going to go for Democrats. We will speak no ill of Bernie Sanders. But as to the new class of which you spoke, yes, that's basically the enemy, those people who have given up on ordinary Americans. And so the campaign recognized that there was a kind of class warfare going on. We would conduct a class warfare against the elite because the elite, these were the people who had created the immobility. And what they had done is having made America immobile and poor and unequal, then promised to be the party of equality and mobility. What lies? Because it was they who placed all the barriers in the path of a people who want to rise through K-12 schools that are third world, through an immigration system that brings in maids and gardeners for the new class, but not people who will help ordinary Americans, and through a broken rule of law which employs them as lawyers and diversity officers and the like. All of those things wonderfully benefit the Hillary voter, the people at the top 10%, and these are the people who, that's their constituency, the top 10% and some of the bottom 10%. And everybody in the middle they gave up on, and as I say, we went after them.
Now, Frank, these people, the new class, and in the political world, the handlers, the consultants, the pollsters, the party officials, these are smart people. They went to top schools. How in the world did they miss this massive middle that was ready to be plucked?
Nick Taleb has a phrase for such people, IYI, intelligent yet idiot. These are the people who I see around me at my libertarian law school. These are people who think that they hold the golden keys that explain everything. They think that the world belongs to the intellectual elite. They don't know too many people at the bottom of the, you know, the intellectual class. And so they became heartless as a consequence, which brings me to another point about Trump. Trump was a class warrior in the sense that he said, it's you, the new class, that's created the problem, and you are cruel hypocrites in denying this. But the other thing about Trump was he was a nationalist. If you're a nationalist, you're necessarily an economic nationalist. That is, you have a sense of fraternity, a sense of looking after all Americans. And what that's going to do is it's going to drag you to the middle of the road or even left of center on things like social welfare. And what that did, what Trump's nationalism did, I mean, this was a feeling throughout the campaign, is it brought him to the sweet spot in American politics. We didn't even know it was a sweet spot. We just sort of figured there's something there.
You've got an interesting chart in the book that breaks down these quadrants on this, but go ahead.
Well, right, so the idea is the sweet spot is composed of people who are culturally nationalistic, as opposed to Hillary.
And Not internationalistic.
On economics, you know, specifically on welfare stuff, on looking after ordinary American workers, middle of the road or left of center, as opposed to the libertarian right. So it was a war fought on two fronts. The more interesting front is what happened to the party in its war against the cruise bots of the world. Right? And of course, now Trump is campaigning for cruise. Fine, good, okay, beats the alternative. But the point is, it was the libertarian right, which was massively rejected in the campaign, and which rejected Trump, and the Never Trump people, many of them are libertarians just like that, and I have a problem with libertarians. I don't think I'd, Americans aren't libertarians, notwithstanding what people say. Americans are nationalists, and they like other Americans. And as for the libertarians, if they were a little more American, they'd be a little less libertarian.
Well, Trump has done more to reduce dependency on the state simply through the employment numbers.
Yeah.
By, I think a lot of the welfare, the means tested supports are down because people are working. They're back to work and wages and not wa- and more are working. Wages aren't going down, they're going up. I saw you the other day, even teenage wages. So in those McDonald's jobs, the wages are up. What better way to meet libertarian conditions, right? Fundamentals.
Yeah, the best kind of social welfare is give people jobs or create the economic conditions where there are jobs. So yeah, this is part of the Trump message is libertarian also. It's libertarian or should be as to corruption, libertarian as to crony capitalism, libertarian with respect to things like real school choice, that is, you know, confessional schools. Right. In all those cases, there's a complete overlap between what Trump was saying and the, you know, the Never Trumper libertarians, except on the subject of let's look after ordinary, decent Americans.
When I remember Trump talking about the wall, people were outraged by this in my world of academia, for instance. And I was just thinking that, you know, the professors, the scientific researchers, so much of the new class, they grew up in a town. They went to college 600 miles away. They got a job in another state. They might have moved around a few times. They travel a lot. Often they go to Europe for conferences or research, and they can't understand with those circumstances. They can't understand someone who has been born and raised and has remained in one town, who might feel the rootedness. You know, that the wall was not about keeping people out. It was for them also, it's a home. How can you have a home? How can you have roots if you don't have boundaries to it? If you don't have some form of organization, some order to it? But it's something that the elite classes, the new classes, they just live differently.
Gee, I was getting embarrassed as you were leading up to that because I thought you were describing me, but then I aspire to be a traitor to my class, so it all works out. I am morally centered in some of my relatives who are of the sort of people you described and think they understand the world and have better feelings for it than any of my colleagues. But then I live with a bunch of law professors, right? That's rather a low bar morally, isn't it? You know?
Okay. Well, when you were talking about the ordinary people, I'm imagining Donald Trump's inauguration speech, and he's got all the high dignitaries behind him, Democrat and Republican, and he just let loose on both sides. And I looked at those faces. They were glum. They didn't know what to think. I think that they must have been angry. They must have been appalled. They must have been frustrated. They must have been sitting there in disbelief.
Yeah.
Their whole world was collapsing.
We elected a fellow who communicated toughness because we thought that only the toughest person in the valley would be the kind of fellow who could take on the swamp. And after we elected him, he turned out to be the kind of person that we elected, a tough person. Some people, by the way, have asked me, you know, how do you explain the fact that this is a New Yorker who, you know, seems to be the leader of a workers' party? And one answer is, well, there are a couple of answers. One is he's not from Manhattan, he's from Queens. But the other thing is, He loved hanging out with the people who were working on his buildings. I mean, it's the people he really liked hanging out with were the construction people, whom he knew well. And in the campaign, we decided, you know, the one thing we're not going to do is go after private sector unions, even their bosses. Public sector, sure, that's the enemy, the teachers union. But private sector, no, we understand the nobility of work.
I read one where they went down to Lower Manhattan to some construction sites and interviewed people during the campaign and asked, who do you like? And they said, Trump.
Yeah.
And they said, why? And he says, he gets us. He gets the union. That doesn't mean he's not going to do battle with the union, but it's a battle where they understand one another. He doesn't have the contempt. He doesn't have the disdain. And when someone said, well before the election, my sister and my brother-in-law, he just hates Hillary. He just despises her. And he's really a Democrat, but he hates Hillary. Why? And I said, because she hates him. Mm-hmm. What's so hard to figure out about this? I mean, do the elite think that the hoi polloi, the ordinary, the management, don't feel the contempt? Do they think they hide it well?
Some people on the left understood what was happening. Michael Moore did. After that happened, Van Jones did. Mostly nobody quite gets it at this point. Reaching out to union people was one part of it. Another part of it was reaching out to Catholics. So Trump started out terribly on Catholics. The big swing constituency in America, determined the winner in every election save 1980. And even then, Catholic vote went up to about 37% from 22%. So, huge swing constituency. What am I talking about? I'm talking about Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. I'm talking about what made the election happen. And so people in the campaign said, for God's sake, you're missing this enormous constituency. What do we do about it? So we got Trump tweeting all over the place about Catholic themes. He did a 1 hour with Raymond Arroyo on EWTN. Catholics were plus 6 and white Catholics were plus 23. I mean, that's a simple explanation for the election.
And Obama won the Catholic vote, yes?
Obama won the Catholic vote in both elections.
There's maybe 55%, I think he got.
It's a swing constituency.
Yeah.
So what was it that turned the dial? Well, Hillary helped, right? I mean, somewhere along the line, people figured out that the gay rights movement was not a shield to protect gay people so much as it was a sword to attack religious believers. There was that, and then there was the very positive outreach by Trump to Catholic voters. And, and I've described this to various people. I described it at one of my workshops. I described this to a New York Times reporter, and in both cases they asked, what's an EWTN?
Right.
And I thought, this is perfect.
These are journalists.
I don't want to tell you.
They've done their homework, haven't they?
They really understand American politics.
Well, do you think this is a little off topic, but do you think that hauling Little Sisters of the Poor before the Supreme Court stuck with some Catholics and that many of them were ready for someone to signal
No question
religious liberty.
No question about that.
Yeah.
And that made the Supreme Court extremely important. And the choice of who was going to be on the Supreme Court was going to be vetted by Don McGahn, but with the assistance of Leonard Leo, who's a very, very devout Catholic. And the people they've come up with are just the kind of people that conservative Catholic voters would have wanted. So anyway, the point I made before is, it's not that Trump was anti-libertarian. He was libertarian with respect to a lot of issues, like school choice and like corruptions, but left of center on welfare. And that was unforgivable for the libertarian right.
I have two things, two little things in the book I want to mention. You call yourself early on, taking a term from a Republican politician with whom you were sitting with, who called some people, quote, right-wing Marxists.
Mm-hmm.
And you said to yourself, Well, that's me. Yeah. What's a right-wing Marxist?
Well, a Marxist, first of all, carries a lot of baggage, which I don't like the term does. But I was Marxist to the extent that I saw all of this through the prism of class politics. I thought that what had happened to America was the American dream had, under Obama, died and would continue to die under Hillary. The American dream is the idea that whoever you are, wherever you're from, you can get ahead and your kids will have it better than you did. And by 2012, Americans no longer believe that their kids would have it better than they did. That, I thought, was the most interesting thing about the 2012 election. None of the Republican candidates got the crucial importance of that. But Obama did. Obama said, I will be the fellow who will bring back equality and mobility. So they ran on that. The Dems ran on that. The Republicans didn't respond, and Obama won the election. And of course, he didn't. He simply made things worse, right? He presided over the jobless recovery of 2009 to 2014, roughly. Really, a really terrible period in the American economy. And you know, people like Christine Lagarde of the IMF said, "Welcome to the new mediocre." All right. And Trump said, no, it doesn't have to be like that. Bernie Sanders also said it doesn't have to be like that. Both of them wanted the socialist goal of an egalitarian society, right? A mobile and egalitarian society. And Sanders proposed socialist means to get to socialist ends, and Trump proposed capitalist or free market means to get to socialist ends. The ends were the same. Right, which is why we weren't going to take on Bernie Sanders. And we thought, look, if it comes down to against Sanders, we've got the ticket. We know how to bring back jobs. He won't. He can't. Right? We're happy to fight that war. But and so I was a Marxist because I thought there was a class struggle going on against the new class. And I was a right-wing Marxist to the extent I thought it was barriers to free markets that had gotten in the way of economic growth.
A journalist said to me the other day that the candidate that the Trump team fears the most in 2020 is Bernie. Mm-hmm. You think that's true?
It's such a dog's breakfast.
Yeah.
How old will Bernie be at that point?
Yeah. But that profile, that kind
but
of
exactly
person
right.
is,
yes.
is the worry.
Right. I don't know anybody but Bernie who could communicate that. I'll tell you an anecdote about Bernie. He was interviewed by the fellow from Vox, Ezra
Klein,
who said, look, how do you feel about open borders, Mr. Sanders? And Sanders said, no, that takes jobs away from Americans. That's a Charles Koch thing. We don't want that.
And Klein was shocked, right?
And Klein thought, oh, well, he's just kind of past his due date, right? He doesn't get kind of the new Democratic Party. Well, of course he didn't. I mean, it was a new Democratic Party that we voted against in 2016. So, you know, there it is, intellectual yet idiot, you know. I mean, all their ideas have been repudiated. And all they've got now is Stormy Daniels. You know, it's a destruction of what used to be a fairly honorable party. It was a party that also believed in dividing people into different groups. But with this difference, when the FDR coalition reached out to the Irish and the Jews and the National Association of Manufacturers and, you know, regular Americans and Baptists and every interest group you can think of, at least the idea then was when you put them all together, somehow the greatest good for the greatest number will emerge. And the problem is nobody believes that right now. Yeah. On the right, it's been destroyed by public choice economics. On the left, it's been destroyed by interest group types who really have given up on, you know, half the people of America, and they don't count anymore. So it was left to Trump to reach out to people, not so much even by constituency, but just on the basis of, hey, we're all Americans.
Right. You know, on that last point about how on the left, the disbelief in any common, right, we're all in this together, you have a line here later in the book that says, no enemies on the left is what liberals still think. Mm-hmm. That was an old old slogan, no enemies to the left, but they still believe this, and your implication is the left now is undermining liberalism lethally. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Actually, the amusing thing about that line, no enemies to the left, is the guy who originated was Kerensky in Russia, which makes it kind of funny. He should have figured it out a few months later. And of course, now you have the Antifa types and the people saying really despicable things on television and the like. And they get no criticism whatsoever. And of course, if you're a Republican, you think, go for it, guys. You're digging your own hole. We're not going to take that shovel away from you. Yes, it's sad and it's pathetic. And one wishes there were another Democratic Party. I think a lot of Democrats have figured out that they've taken a wrong turn.
Well, I being on college campuses for a long time, mingling with the faculty, most of whom are liberals, and actually they're far more frightened of the hard leftists than of any conservative. And it's not just because there are fewer conservatives, because there aren't really that many hard left figures, but they're frightened to death
of leftists. Yeah, probably most college administrators are happier with Betsy DeVos as in the Department of Education.
In truth,
than your predecessors with the Dear Colleague letters.
Right.
Let me say something about liberalism, as you've mentioned it. I think it's very important to distinguish between the modern Democratic Party and liberalism, because, of course, the two no longer have much in common with one another. But in addition, I'd like to rescue the idea of liberalism precisely because of its Christian or Judeo-Christian roots. Liberalism didn't come out of nowhere. Liberalism is very much the product of a Judeo-Christian tradition in which everybody has a soul, and which, in the case of a Catholic religion, aspires to be universal. Which says we're universal. That, it seems to me, is the origin of human rights, the idea of human dignity. And that, shorn of that religious tradition, the sense of dignity disappears so quickly, so quickly. You can so easily understand the movement to euthanasia, abortion rights. When you think of a liberalism or a new liberalism which has totally abandoned its religious faith, I went to school in a parochial school, and I don't remember the word right ever being used by the nuns. Duty, yes, right, but not rights. But nevertheless, that was a kind of liberalism, right? It was the best kind of liberalism because it was a liberalism rooted in an instinct of charity to other people. So what I got, I think, was something which made me liberal in a sense that many of these people never could be, both on the right and on the left.
In that case, Frank, where is the Democratic Party heading? I don't see the tendency that you just described in any way in the near future being curtailed.
From your lips to God's ears? Well, it does look a little bit like a death spiral. I mean, what exactly, for God's sakes, what were they thinking? And I'll tell you, it seems to me that they thought, they said it clearly enough, that the arc of history bent only in their direction. They believe that stuff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They thought that in the fullness of time, everything they believed would come to be supported by most Americans. It was the Whig theory of history, camouflaged as a campaign strategy.
We are waiting for.
Yeah, the point is, we don't have to do a thing. It's all going to come to us. So we don't have to advance ideas. Right, whatever they are, it's all going to come to us. So they're not the party of ideas any longer. They're the party of screeching and trivial issues, and brat-like behavior, and undisguised hatred.
I was told that Hillary's infamous deplorables statement was deliberate and thought out, and that she and a few of her advisors believe this is a political winner for us. Mm-hmm. How, again, I guess if you believe that history with a capital H is on your side and that you are the carrier of the zeitgeist, then you don't need to pause and reflect and consider. Now, what I'm saying here, is this really leadership, except
for one thing, you can believe that, but you don't have to voice it. If you think it's all going to fall into your lap, you don't have to go out of your way to smirk at your opponents, unless it's a party that thrives and lives upon hatred. So, I mean, one of the most delicious of human pleasures is a sense of justified hatred. And that's what Hillary was inviting people to experience. I know you don't quite like me, I get that, right? There was that famous comment in the 2012 debate, you know, you're all right, Hillary. People don't quite like me, but we hate the same people, and let's just luxuriate in that. So, you know, this is a party that condemns the sense of hatred of fascism in the other party, but it's built upon it.
So much of it seems, the expression of it seems gratuitous. The aggression wants to come out.
Right.
Even when it's not necessary. I mean, I remember after the Obergefell decision, Obama illuminated the White House in rainbow colors. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, you know, this is the people's house. What you're doing is you're taking the people who were dismayed by the decision. You've won. Mm-hmm. You won. And you've got to rub their noses right down there in the dirt. What is this for? This was unnecessary.
Well, yes, unless there's something else going on, which is an invitation to hatred. So to bolster my argument, consider what happened immediately after the same-sex marriage decision. On a dime, the left turned onto the next great craze, which is transgender right. Now look, if gays are, you know, 2% of the population, and the gays who want to get married are maybe 1%, then the number of transgender people out there is the smallest fraction imaginable. And yet, you know, these are the people one reads about again and again in places like the New York Times and the Washington Post. Why is that? Well, it's not because we like these people. It's not because we like these transgender people. We don't know any of them. However, we get to hate the people who have problems with them. But what bothers me about all that is their demand for respect.
I think affirmation.
We'd get along a lot better if we thought that, paradoxically, people are permitted to dislike you, right? There'd be more respect for other people if we didn't try to force it down their throat.
Indeed.
It's the people who not merely want to be left alone, but can't live with the idea that there are people who think them problematical, who cause the problem. You can't legislate that kind of respect.
I mean, one of the foundations of liberalism is you allow people to have bad thoughts. As long as they don't act them out onto other people, you give people freedom of thought, freedom of conscience, and you give them a little private space.
Yeah, strategically though, it's in some respects a brilliant move by the left because it permits them to attack their great eternal enemy, which is the Catholic Church. So they've got things figured out.
Oh, well, we're going to see what happens in November. That's what everyone's thinking about, right? And if not 2020. Let me say again, the Republican Workers Party, Frank Buckley's book, Encounter Books. And Frank, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.